Well, jump aboard this discussion. I've got Paul Ehrlich with us, The Annihilation of Nature. Fascinating, fascinating, fascinating. So we'll take your calls when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Paul Ehrlich with us, of course, and we will get to your calls in a second here. Paul, many of the things we've discussed are not popular at all, are they?
That's true. If they were popular, we'd be in much better shape.
Yeah, absolutely. The critters that are being eliminated by us, what are they? Are they like little frogs and things like that? What is going into this mass extinction?
Well, there's a huge variety of things that are being eliminated. We chose for the book, for The Annihilation of Nature, pictures of birds and mammals that most people are probably, most of them, not familiar with, but are absolutely glorious and interesting. So we hoped that by having a book that would make a wonderful Christmas present, sort of a coffee table book that gives some people an idea of what we're losing, it would lure them into reading the text, which tells them why we're losing it, why it's extremely bad for us and our kids, and what the hell we ought to do about it. So, for example, I was in Tasmania in Australia, where there's a very beautiful parrot called the orange-bellied parrot that's disappearing in part because of habitat destruction. It used to migrate, still migrates to southern Australia from Tasmania, but a lot of its habitat is gone. And from the change of the fire regime that the Aborigines ran for thousands of years, that is not as favorable to the, they wiped out the Aborigines, and the land has reverted to a less favorable situation for the parrot. And this is sort of the story of things around the world. For example, numbers are no protection. We had billions of passenger pigeons in North America. They used to arrive and form breeding colonies of millions of birds. And they were so common that everybody fed on them, all the local predators fed on them. As we drove railroads into their stronghold in the Middle West, they used to shoot them, ship them back to New York and Philadelphia and so on, and use them, both their squabs, their youngsters, for food. And they were common enough that the adults were used as live targets in shooting galleries. And they seemed perfectly secure. They were maybe the second commonest bird on the entire planet. But we shot them down to the point where they no longer could form these huge breeding colonies, which they needed to survive.
Oh,
and the last one died in the St. Louis Zoo, Cincinnati Zoo, something like 1913. Her name was Martha. She was named after the wife of the first president of the United States, Martha Washington.
And how do we know, Paul, that these creatures have been eliminated?
Well, nobody's seen one now for 150 years, and there are a lot of bird watchers, but we do see the results, because if it weren't for wiping them out, we wouldn't have the huge problems with Lyme disease that we have in the Middle West and the East, because they used to eat, compete with food for the deer mice that are the carriers of Lyme disease.
And ticks and things like that.
So we made a paradise for Lyme disease by wiping out a resource which could still be feeding us today if we had harvested it sensibly. And that's another typical example of the kinds of things we're losing.
Why can't we eliminate things like ticks and get rid of them instead of the quality?
It would be nice to be able to pick what populations we reduced, but we're actually doing it the opposite. For instance, we've carried a disease called, I guess, white nose disease of bats around North America now, so that we're losing the bats. And the bats, of course, not only eat a lot of the insects that would that eat our crops, but also carry viruses.
Right.
Eat the mosquitoes that carry viruses
to
us. So we're screwing around with nature in ways we don't really know. In some ways, we may help ourselves, but in most, we're taking a complex system that we have to interact with and changing it in random ways that are usually destructive. It's like, you know, when you say, well, who cares if you wipe out that kind of rodent or that kind of bird or whatever? And the answer is, usually you don't know what the effects will be until you've done it. It's like asking, what are the odds if I thrust a screwdriver into the guts of my computer? Is it likely to make it better or make it worse? And most of the times it'll make it worse when you disrupt a complicated interacting system.
Yeah.
And it's exactly the same with wiping out the populations and species of our life support system.
Paul, I'm a believer in life out there on other planets. I just think this universe is way too vast not to have that. And just looking at good old planet Earth as an example and the vastness of life and the different kinds of species we have here, I've got to believe the formula is the same if you find the right complexion and the right primordial soup somewhere. But if there are civilizations out there and they're 20,000 years ahead of us or a million years ahead of us, do you think they have learned how to control their population and keep themselves from being extinct?
Well, if they lasted that long, they must have. Because even at an incredibly slow rate of increase, you know, say 0.01% a year, you still end up in a few million years with more people or more organisms than there are elementary particles in the universe. There are roughly 300 sextillion stars. That's 300 followed by 21 zeros. That's more stars than there are grains of sand on the Earth.
Yeah.
And if out there, I would be very surprised if out there there weren't many planets that have the right conditions for life and that life of some form would evolve on them. But this is no solution to our problems. If, for example, Mars were as habitable as the United States, I don't remember what the exact numbers are now, but at the growth rates of 30 or so years ago, if all the airliners of Earth could carry people to Mars and do the trip, round trip in 30 days and fly continuously, they couldn't keep the population, and were fully loaded, they couldn't keep the population of Earth from growing. In other words, we took all the surplus and tried to send them to Mars. So we're stuck on this little planet. If you talk about, of course, distant stars, the problems become infinitely worse. So I'd like to think there's other life out there, but all we know about is the ones we have here on our single little planet. We haven't even managed to show for sure that there was life on Mars.
At what point did we start gobbling up resources and eliminating other creatures?
Well,
200 years ago, 100 years ago?
Our biggest mistake was the agricultural revolution, if it turns out to be a mistake. It may have been a wonderful thing, but once we got to the stage where a single person or a single family could produce and grow more food than was necessary for themselves, you got the division of labor that led eventually to soldiers, priests, scientists, and TV, radio and TV people. And that was what really opened the door. And the issue still is, was that a mistake, or are we going to learn to live with each other and with our environment and have a long-term sustainable society? Sadly, the odds are dropping, but it's still possible.
Okay, let's go to the phones now. They're all lining up here for you, Paul. We'll pick it up by going to Linda in Kingman, Arizona, west of the Rockies, to get stuff started here. Hi, Linda.
Oh, hi. First time I've ever called in. With all due respect, Mr. Ehrlich, you're nuts. I didn't crawl out of a sludge pond. I was created by God Almighty in His image. It's amazing to me that you're all for saving the animals and vegetation and so on, but you understand that everything you said is you're opposed to the human population. You said all women should have access to free abortion, so we don't have any more people who are made in God's image, whether you know it or not. You're going to die someday, and then you will know there is a God. You can't tell me you can stand outside, look at the wonderful sky at night, and not believe that something greater than yourself and a sludge pond made us.
Well, there's
God, and He did create us. Everything's perfect. The sun is the right amount of miles from the Earth. The moon is the right. Everything on Earth has been made perfect
for you
to keep life going.
Hold on, Linda.
You believe apparently that the more solar systems than there are grains of sand on Earth were created 6,000 years ago by a supernatural entity, and that satisfies you. My question to you is, who created the supernatural entity? And then who
He says in Exodus, I am that I am.
Yeah, well,
even having a baby is a miracle if you think about it. So
no, it's not a miracle. All kinds of people and animals have babies. And you really got to think about what's going to happen to your children. Stop worrying about the quantity of people. We have many. More can be produced by unskilled labor that enjoys its work. You got to start thinking about the quality of life and finding yourself a evidence-based.
Well, then, Paul,
approach.
I haven't heard
not,
you...
Not
I,
a faith-based approach. Faith is for idiots.
I haven't heard you say, though, that you are a non-believer in some kind of force that put this all together.
There are all kinds of things I don't understand, but I don't make up childish stories to explain them. It's very simple. In other words, I'm not an atheist. I would never define myself.
I would call you an agnostic.
Yeah, you know what? I'm not an atheist. I'm not a leprechaunist. I'm not an a tooth fairyist. I'm not an a Jack Frostist. I'm not even an a Porky Pigist.
Are you telling me you don't believe in Santa Claus?
Well, Santa Claus, there's a little evidence for because he brought me stuff when I was a kid.
That's right.
But I certainly don't think that science tells us everything we would like to know about the universe or the multiverse, depending on what you have. In other words, you just have to admit your ignorance of some things and don't come up with silly stories, because silly stories are dangerous. They're dangerous for your kids. They're dangerous for your grandchildren.
But I think, in getting back to her, Linda, for a moment, I think you can believe in a creator, believe in a God, but that doesn't negate the fact that things are out of control on this planet.
I'm a firm believer you can believe anything you want as long as you don't try and take your beliefs that have no evidence behind them to change my life, your life, or the fate of the world. And we, you know, it's too bad we've never really grown up as a species, so we know completely where religion comes from. And it has served us, in some cases, very well, and in other cases, hideously. And I think we're in a period now where you're seeing hideous at every level, because it's blocking action on the things that are destroying our children and grandchildren's world, and it's leading to all kinds of hideous things right now, as you can tell by just turning on the TV, or the radio. So.
You sound a little like Professor Richard Dawkins.
Yeah, well, one of the things Dawkins said that I happen to agree with is that giving your child religious indoctrination is a form of child abuse.
He did say that, didn't he? He did say that. He did say that.
Hell yeah. Well, a lot of people have said that. In other words, you want to have a population that is oriented towards evidence, what we do know about and what we can do about those things. You don't want to imagine, for example, that some supernatural monster is going to come in at the last minute and fix the climate for us.
That's not going to happen.
Well, if it does, I'll be very happy.
Well, I would too, but I don't think that's going to happen, unfortunately. What's the United Nations doing about any of this?
Well, they tend to convene meetings. I think people run down the United Nations, in a sense, unnecessarily. It is not able to function for many reasons as a world government, but it does a lot of things about trying to inform people about the world, to trying to fix things and so on, that are better than not having it. But we, you know, the nation state is over. We have demonstrated very clearly, it's only about a 200-year-old phenomenon anyway, that it can't handle global problems. And the climate is a very good example. Well, we've had 21 big meetings, and we're still not doing it. So we really need to think about the problem that faced the founding fathers of the United States. You know, they had big discussions. There were 13 colonies, which could be thought of as the equivalent of the 150 or whatever it is nations now, that needed to solve some of their joint problems, like what to do if the British came back and how to handle international trade. And there was a long series of debates that are well worth reading about in the process of adopting the Constitution. And they had demographic. How do you retain your national, your statewide features? They often fought with each other while still doing the things you had to do jointly. They were concerned very much about demography. Madison asked the question, how many people can a representative reasonably represent? In other words, how many people should each congressman represent? And he said he thought the maximum was about 30,000, as I recall correctly, which meant, you know, if you lived in a town of 30,000, you could know enough people and get the pulse of the town well enough and so on to represent it. Now the average congressman, I think, represents something like 800,000 people. democracy has been very much diluted in our country by population growth alone. And if you keep it up, the more people you have, the more diluted your say and the say of each individual is going to be. We're working against individualism. And the funny thing is, the people working hardest against us are the ones who presumably value it most.
What if we are on a planet that helps create these mass extinctions as a natural form of its evolution? And so the next extinction, you know, that's the way it is.
We go, that's right. That's possible. I mean, I try and take the position that I want the most people to live really decent lives. You can always say the solution to the population problem is a super Ebola that kills off 6.5 billion people. Take us down to that 500 million area and so on. I have a personal ethical belief coming no doubt largely from my mother that you try and take care of every person you have once they're here. In other words, you focus very much on giving everybody a decent life, not on trying to maximize the number of people, even if that costs most people a decent life. You got to remember, 800 million people are starving today. Roughly 2 billion are micronutrient malnourished. That means that somewhere between 2 and 3 billion of the 7.3 billion people on the planet are leading lives that your listeners would never trade for.
No, never, not at all. At our worst day, we wouldn't want it.
That's right. I mean, if you've traveled around and seen what other people put up with, or you've read, for example, what most women in India have to put up with, it would tell you something about whether or not you want to maximize the number of people or whether you want to maximize the number in the very long run while having everybody lead a really decent life.
I was in Jamaica about 15 years ago, and I couldn't believe the huts with metal little tin things for roofs that people were living in. I mean, it was unbelievable.
Well, my friends of mine befriended an Indian woman who was their housekeeper, a young woman who wanted to get married. And to get married, she had to go back to her village. And my friend went to the wedding in a village where there was no toilet of any kind. You know that about half the people in India have to relieve themselves outdoors.
Outdoors, yeah. And they're used to that.
Well, but they're not used to the husband who really just, it turned out, wanted to slave for his mother, had a girlfriend in the next village, and yet if the young woman who married him wants to get away, wants to leave, she's likely to be killed.
Yeah, no, you're right. You're right. That's unbelievable.
I mean, the lives that other people live, people have no idea of, unfortunately.
How do we get the book, Annihilation of Nature?
Go to Amazon, and that's Amazon, to the advanced search site. It's easy to find, just advanced books, advanced search books in Amazon. Put in E-H-R-L-I-C-H in the author, that's me, and put in Annihilation in the title, and you'll get right
and
to
you'll
it.
Pop right up there.
And
right.
Remember, every nickel of royalties goes to training people who are trying to solve the problem.
Paul,
we're paid for the illustrations, but we're not taking any money out of it at all. It's strictly part of the program.
We're going to come back and take some final calls with you in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Don't touch your dial. Well, a major story we've been following tonight, a major police operation underway in a Paris suburb against suspects linked to that very deadly terrorist attack that rocked the French capital 5 days ago. The targets of the raid are believed to include the mastermind of the attacks. We're going to go to KFI in Los Angeles, reporter Steve Gregory, for the latest. And Steve, I understand there are a couple deaths involved here. What do we know?
That's right, George. And one of the terrorists was actually shot and killed by a police sniper. And a woman blew herself up with a suicide vest. Now, those are the two deaths that are reported, presumably, from the group that might be responsible for that attack last week, as you mentioned. Sadly, a civilian passerby, too. It looks like just someone, an innocent bystander, was also killed during the operation. At least three police officers were also wounded in this raid. Now, if you want to take this kind of a step back, this event has been unfolding for the last few hours in this Paris suburb called Saint-Denis, and this is one of those things where officials in Paris had great intel very quickly, And this attack 5 days ago, this is pretty unprecedented to get this kind of intel and get this kind of aggression and get in there that quickly, sort of surgically removing these people. And they found where they were at, holed up in this suburb. It's sort of amazing work on the part of the French police.
All right, Steve, thank you so much for that update. As we've been reporting throughout the night, this major police operation underway in Paris, they are not going to stop. They're going to be relentless. Sadly, a passerby was in the wrong place at the wrong time. That person is dead, got shot by someone during the operation. But as Steve just reported, one of the thugs, terrorists, is dead. The other terrorist or thug, a woman, blew herself up. She had the belt strapped around her. And we'll continue to monitor this story as the law enforcement in Paris just continues to do what it needs to do to get these people. Hey, welcome back to Coast, our final segment with Paul Ehrlich here and your calls. We're talking about his incredible work called The Annihilation of Nature. And Paul, it seems like mankind is annihilating themselves, doesn't it, with all the stories that keep breaking?
Well, again, civilization is annihilating itself. Whether all people would disappear is a question that depends on what form the annihilation takes. In other words, if we have a full-scale nuclear war, we could easily have a breakdown that spread so far and made so much trouble that eventually humanity would die out. If it's a more gradual process, then people may find some ways to have small, isolated groups that manage to persist with some kind of technology. Nobody really knows. As I said before, I just don't want to run the experiment.
One of the things I used to say is we might not be able to solve the problems of the planet. So create an island for yourself, for your family, for the people you love, and try to make that life as comfortable as you can. But these outside influences, they will shatter that, won't they?
That's the problem. If the climate changes enough, it doesn't matter what the hell you've done. There's not going to be anything we can do about it. Or if there is if the population gets the size that we generate a virus or a bacterium that basically kills everybody it touches. Again, you know, a super Ebola, something like that. Mm-hmm. And these are always evolving. So the survivalist approach, I'm afraid, won't work as a way of protecting yourself as an individual, to say nothing of if you've been the person who's had the foresight, you know, and preserved food and have your little plot of land and so on, what's to keep the people with no foresight, which are characteristic of most of our people? They don't have any foresight about anything except maybe trying to look forward to their own retirement. They'll just come and take it from you.
You remember the Twilight Zone when you were younger?
Oh, yeah.
There was an episode called The Shelter, and the family had a bomb shelter. And it was during the Cold War, obviously. And during one of the raids, it turned out to be, they thought, real. And so the family went into their fallout shelter. They had water and food put in there. And the entire neighborhood wanted in. So it just shows them trying to pound down the shelter, trying to get in. And the guy wouldn't open the door. And it was horrible. They hated each other. They're screaming. And then all of a sudden, an announcement would come on that it was a false alarm. It was a test.
Well, you know, around the same time, somebody built a fallout shelter in L.A., and there was a brush fire, and it was destroyed by the brush fire. So it's not the way to go. I mean, it's just like people talking of crazy ideas about somehow recreating extinct things from the DNA. It's generally impossible, but you know, it's so much easier and so much cheaper to save the stuff we've already got than it is to go off on these science fiction ideas or the thought that you, a citizen of a highly industrialized, totally intertwined, utterly interdependent civilization, can somehow save yourself by moving into the woods.
Let's go to the calls now. John in Sebring, Florida. Hi, John. Thanks for holding. You're up. Go ehead.
Honored to be on with Mr. Ehrlich. Paul, thank you, sir, for your career and your writing.
Thank you for calling in.
I'll be looking for your book, The Annihilation of Nature, and let us know if there's any way we can email you and have discussions with you. I'm a man of faith, and I heard what you said earlier. I don't mind being called an idiot.
No. You know, sometimes you have a short circuit between your brain and your mouth. If you're interested in pushing your views, go to mahb.stanford.edu. mahb.stanford.edu, and it's a group of people who are trying to get everybody, whatever their views are, to get together and save the situation, because we're not getting the results we need from politicians. We got to do it ourselves.
What should the average
faith have a really important role to play, as the Pope showed?
Trying to say what should the average citizen be doing to help in all that you're trying to help us understand, and you're having success with it to some degree. Thanks for those donations going for the studies. I just want to suggest to you, I'm interested in you as an individual, and I just want to ask you this. You might not want to answer, but what religion were you raised, and what religion do you practice today? And thanks if you'll give us some answer on that.
I'd be happy to give an answer. I was raised with very little religion, and of course, most of the people I know don't have a faith-based world. The problem is basically there's a lot of things we don't know, but inventing things to fill that gap doesn't help at all. We've learned one hell of a lot about how the world works in the last couple hundred years. I hope we're going to continue to. We'll probably never get all the answers, even the answers of how our brains actually work, how we get consciousness, for example. It's a great mystery. But if you say somebody created that, then the automatic question for a scientist comes up: if you have to have a creator for that, then who created the creator? And if you have to have a super creator for that, then you got to have a super super creator who created the super creator. It's turtles all the way down. So I just don't get any personal satisfaction from imagining a creator. I just have to be satisfied with a lot of things that science doesn't understand and that I don't understand, that probably I never will and science never will.
Well, that's the key point, Paul. I think the bottom line here is we may never get the answers to how we got here, where we're headed. But the fact is, though, we are here.
And people, regardless if they're deeply religious or full-scale atheists, can all work together to solve the problem. One of the nice things in theory about the United States is that we can have all kinds of different views, but we don't attack other people for their views. We let them think whatever they want, but hope they'll work together with us to make the United States the kind of country we'd all like it to be.
Well, that's what I like about this show. I mean, people might not agree with you. Some people may, but at least you have a right to get on this program without me attacking you.
And of course, there are very few places in the world where that's true, unhappily. Not in Russia, not in China, not in North Korea, and so on. And it's something I think is very valuable and will eventually, again, I disagree with the Pope on many things, but what he said about climate, what he said about the economic system, were right on, and I'm delighted he said them.
Let's go to Dan in Buffalo, New York now. Hi, Dan. Thank you for calling. Go ahead, sir.
Well, hi. You know, I admire your graciousness towards we primitive theological types. I personally, though, remember you since the 70s, and your predictions are on a par with Criswell's. And I would like people to look up Julian Simon.
I'm losing you, Dan. Get back on your phone.
Okay. Do you hear the name Julian Simon?
Yeah, Julian.
People like Ehrlich and Peter Singer and Ezekiel Emanuel are doing their best to bring eugenics back out of disrepute. And I think he's been soft-pedaling it a bit tonight, but those of us who know him over the years know this.
Well, just plain. I think the technical term is crap. I have been an enemy of eugenics for all my life. My training is in genetics. I've written books attacking eugenics. I have written many articles attacking eugenics. That's just wrong. But again, you probably have been listening to the wrong radio stations, which just lie to you all the time. It's a common thing. I'm called a racist. I actually was involved in inventing the sit-in when we desegregated the restaurants of Lawrence, Kansas in the 1950s. I have been a crusader on issues of racial justice and gender justice and so on. And eugenics is just a crock.
Do you get attacked a lot, Paul, when you're on programs?
Oh, sure. But, that comes with the territory.
True, true.
Yeah.
But, do they do it with respect or are they vicious?
It varies, but then sometimes I lose my sense of respect, which is not good.
Do you? Aha.
I do have a little temper. Actually, the last caller hit the wrong button because having spent my entire life as a crusader for racial justice and gender justice and so on, having risked my life to desegregate restaurants in the 1950s, having parents who didn't mind if I used the famous F... word, would say, don't say that because it will upset your grandmother, but if I said NIG... then I'd get my mouth washed out with soap. So when I'm called a eugenicist or a racist, it annoys me.
Well, yeah, I can understand how that can be. And in his...
The reader ought to look up the book, The Race Bomb, which was written about 30 years ago. And it's still available, I think, on Amazon.
Let me ask you, are you frustrated at the rate that this is going?
Oh, I'm frustrated as hell because I have great-grandchildren, and I want them to have a decent world to live in. And I have lots of friends with young children and with younger my grandchildren are already colleagues, and I am very frustrated with the rate. And I'm very frustrated with the performance of our political system, and most of our politicians. There are exceptions. I'm frustrated.
What would you do to a politician who would say, we can't stop this until we eliminate 6.5 billion people and start all over with a low number? And the only way we're going to do it, folks, is we're going to stop right now, for the time being, your ability to have a baby. We're, like you said, we're putting this stuff in this secret sauce in your water, and that's the way it's going to be. And then as people die off, they die off. You get to a certain age, whatever it is, 60, 70, you're going to be extinguished. That's the only way we can save this planet.
Well, I would say is it's a stupid plan because you don't need to do that. It's immoral, unethical, and also will cause the society to dissolve because nobody will put up with it. When you think of the problems China had, just trying to limit each family to one child, which was an attempt to give their population a much better life. In other words, they did it in response to a big economic study, which showed that they couldn't bring themselves out of poverty if their population growth continued the way it was going. There's details in that, but I won't worry about them. The basic point is even that caused enormous disruption. So we got to do it the sane way by starting on things that many people, like giving women equal rights and equal opportunities, would approve of and move in that direction.
Let's go to...
If you want to have a death rate solution, that is, kill off large numbers of people, then you're siding with the terrorists in Mumbai.
Yeah, no, you are. You're right.
Nuclear war.
Absolutely right.
Nuclear war is a great population control measure. I'm against it.
I keep thinking of the movie Soylent Green. Remember that one?
Oh, yeah. Book and movie.
Wafers. Stay away from wafers, Paul. Yeah. Let's go to Virginia, Jacksonville, Florida. Hey, Virginia, go ahead.
Yes, good morning. I can relate to Mr. Oh, gosh.
Really?
I already have a senior moment here. Anyway, Mr. Paul Ehrlich.
Yep.
When I was I was born in 1932, so I can relate to everything he's saying.
Oh, same year.
And the
happy birthday to both of you.
Yeah, thank you. only the good die young, so I'll probably be around a long time. That's my theory. That lady who called was relying on religion to save everything and not enough on reality. And I remember I was at Pearl Harbor when it was attacked.
Oh, boy.
You know how old we were then. And our house was being machine gunned. Well, that was my first introduction to the real world. And then we were evacuated, my mother and I, to the States. And we spent the war years there seeing another type of existence in a small Georgia town. When we returned to the islands, they became a state later, and they started tearing out all the vegetation and shrubbery and building roads that go nowhere and ruining the islands.
Yeah, I know Hawaii quite well, and you're absolutely right. Actually, I gave a lecture today in the retirement home where Ann and I have an apartment, and it was interesting as compared with my undergraduate students at Stanford, I could actually talk to them about things like Pearl Harbor, and they knew what I was referring to.
Yeah.
That's super ancient history to most college students today.
Some students, Paul, you talk to them about Kennedy's assassination, they don't know what you're talking
about. Right, exactly. There are certain advantages to being older. Not many, though. Old age is not really for sissies.
Wouldn't we all rather be young with the same knowledge we have right now in memory?
A miracle, yes.
That would be it. Well, you got a lot of work at hand, my friend, because this is not an easy task.
Well, you're working at it, too, so let's just keep going.
We must, we must. Okay, you take care of yourself, Paul. Have yourself a great Thanksgiving, okay?
You, too. It was a great evening. Thank you.
Paul Ehrlich, the name of the book is The Annihilation of Nature, Human Extinction of Birds and Mammals as well. It's a great book, and it's a great story. The big question is how do you take care of this situation? How do you fix it? How do you get the population to slow down? That is going to be the puzzlement. It sure is. We're going to come back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM, and Dr. Bruce Goldberg joins me. You know, he's the expert on hypnotherapy and reincarnation and teleportation. And he's going to talk about his new work, of course, called Exploring the Fifth Dimension, Parallel Universes, Teleportation, and Out-of-Body Travel. So let's enjoy our moment here with Dr. Bruce Goldberg. And if you need to email me, that's george@coasttocoastam.com. And also, don't forget, those of you who want to meet up with folks, paranormaldate.com. That's paranormaldate.com. And use the coupon code TURKEY. I kid you not. Paranormaldate.com.